This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Hey everyone, I'm Nate from the Full Mutuality podcast. I wanted to take a moment to say thank you for tuning into this show. We're so grateful that you've decided to spend your time with us. Seriously, Dan, Gail, Jessica, Kathleen, Scott, and the rest of us here at the Dauntless Media Collective couldn't produce content like the show you're listening to without your support. I'd also like to invite you even further into the conversation. Right now, there are some great discussions happening over in the Dauntless Media Collective Discord server. If you're interested in chatting with other folks who are deconstructing and decolonizing the oppressive traditions that they came from, please feel free to hop on into the server. If you don't know what Discord is, it's a place where communities can gather online for chatting on a wide variety of topics. In our Discord server, we have channels devoted to general deconstruction conversations, some meme sharing, therapeutic venting about whatever religious bullshit you're currently dealing with, and even a channel specifically devoted to talking about the latest episodes of the podcast you're listening to right now. I hope you'll join us. You can log in directly to the Dauntless server by clicking the link in the show notes or heading to dauntless.fm and clicking the link in the top banner. See you there.
All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter. Okay.
Another episode of the Thereafter podcast. Your hosts, Megan Crozier, Courtney Coffey here. Megan, hello. Say hello.
I thought you were, when you said Megan Crozier, Courtland Coffey, I thought you were saying, like, your host, Megan Crozier, and that I was supposed to say Courtland Coffey as if we reversed roles.
Ooh,
for the day.
I like that. We should have seen if we would have planned ahead, we could have done that, but I just went in, just no plan.
Yeah, no, but I also, I don't know if I could channel the Enneagram 7 that you, that embodies you, and I don't know if you could channel the anxiety of the Enneagram 1 that I carry with me at all times.
I don't know. I've found if you do enough Enneagram 7-ing, you eventually get to a level of paralyzing anxiety. Like that is the end result.
Yeah.
of saying yes to every new opportunity that comes your way.
Yeah. I'm trying to reframe. I'm trying to think of a better way to say paralyzing. Maybe anxiety.
I almost didn't say it because I was worried that it might be an ableist term, but I really couldn't think of another word.
It is. It is. I think a word, anxiety that prevents you from being able to move forward on it. There's a way.
There is. I literally thought about it as I was like about to say it, and I was like, nope, can't. I don't have anything else. It was like the little apple spinning wheel of death was going on in my brain.
Well, and we've talked about this on the pod. I think this is interesting. And we'll get in. We have some great stuff to talk about today. We're just kind of we have Matt back part two. But one thing I do want to say is I do sometimes struggle with when to point out and when to not point out things like that, because there's a lot of reframing of vocabulary, especially when it comes to ableist language, but also language that's rooted in white supremacy. I can give an example. In the education world, people talk about the quote-unquote achievement gap, and they're reframing that as an opportunity gap because of the roots in white supremacy that phrase has. And if you're familiar with Ijeoma Oluwau, she talks about that a little bit in her book, So You Want to Talk About Race. But things like that, it's always a wonder of mine when it's appropriate to kind of pause and whether I have that social equity with someone, because I have been in situations where I have said, like, hey, you just said this phrase and the way that it comes across, like, I just want to, you know, be careful because, and, you know, I'll use an example. Somebody said, like, I have a friend that is a wheelchair user, but they're really smart. And I was like, oh, it feels like you're trying to convey that someone that's a wheelchair user would have a cognitive disability, you know? And I was like, I know that's not your, and they got real defensive and they were like, no, that's not what I was trying to say. And I'm like, okay, I'm trying to just kind of help so that your relationship with your friend isn't impacted, you know? And also so that your friend doesn't always have to be the one that is saying, like, hey, this language can be harmful. But I sometimes feel like the progressive, exhausting person to have around that's like, I'm not trying to be like, gotcha, but I don't know.
I think it is complicated. And as you love to hear, I don't think that there is like a right answer or a rigid set of rules, unfortunately.
Give me the rule, damn it, and I'll follow the rules.
However, I do think that there is, I hear people talk about this, and I think that there is like a, you know, somewhat of a calculus or like an equation of like what's the benefit of this in this given situation? Like what's the, you know, extent of impact, right? Like, so like whether we're having a conversation just two people or we're having a broader conversation, or are there other benefits that are going to get lost if we sidetrack the conversation? Like if we're talking about something, you know, if we're talking about a particular issue that may get essentially like deprioritized because we get distracted mincing words, then maybe not. But if there is an opportunity to elevate whatever's happening with an additional point, I don't know. Like I think that there's a lot of like factors to consider. And I think about that stuff all the time as well.
And here's what I'll say though, like, okay, you know, changing your language is important. That also, like, you don't use ableist language. Also, don't be ableist, right? And so I think that, like, sure, it's really important to change your language, but also change your actions and things like that. But I also, I feel like one of the questions that we ask a lot of our guests on the podcast is, because a lot of our guests have intersectional identities, and I often ask, like, what is it like to have XYZ identity? And then also, by default, have to become an advocate, an activist for that identity. Like, you can't just be trans in the United States. You have to be a trans activist. You can't just be disabled. You have to suddenly be a disabled activist. And so I feel like if I can help people in my circle of influence just a little bit to understand a little bit of ableism and ableist language, or understand like, hey, that was a transphobic thing that you said, or if I can help a little bit, then I feel like it can help, you know, reduce that effort and energy that our friends that have to do that all the time have to expend. But I also see, you know, it's a balance. And we're just, these are the kind of conversations we usually have in private, and we're just having them here on the podcast.
Yeah. And I think that is a big piece of it, is like having these conversations outside of the specific situation. Like, obviously, like, what triggered this? And it was like using the word triggered, that came up in something that we were talking about off mic, when you're like, I wish I had a different word that wasn't as, it was pull the trigger. When are we going to pull the trigger? Anyway, language is wild, y'all. But sometimes it's like, how can we have conversations with our friends or within the relational context that we live in before something happens? And in the same way that, like, I've heard people talk about consent in this way of like, oh, how do you talk about consent in situations before you get into the situation? Like, we understand that it may, you know, steal some of the magic away, right, from an impulsive moment to be like, hey, stop, let me check these four consent boxes. But you could have a conversation with your date or your partner or your person beforehand about, like, how they feel about impulsivity and how they respond to, physical touch in situations. Like, you could have conversations about things before they are the thing of the moment. And I think also with, these conversations about harm mitigation and harm reduction and changing of language, if we're having those conversations and talking about these things, not just when they come up because there's an issue, but proactively and intentionally, like, hey, we all want to work on, how to adjust the way that we are using language. Almost in the same way, like, you hear people talk about, like, people who slip up on pronouns or, like, misgender. And then, like, I've had a lot of trans friends, especially trans non-binary friends, who have said, like, it's so frustrating when someone, like, stops everything and they're like, oh my God, I didn't say they, them, I'm so sorry. And then makes it a 5-minute ordeal instead of just going like, oh, okay, yeah. And then just moves on. Because they're like, yeah. I don't need my misgendering to become a 5-minute like soapbox for you to get on and
where you're centered.
Yeah. And we talk about it and make it this big thing. So I think normalizing having these conversations outside of the moment where an issue comes up is a big piece of it. Because to your point, they are important. They're important things to think about. They're not just like gotcha moments for woke points, right? Like,
yeah, and I think too, like, think. Yeah, we, I also think that we know the people in our lives that want to learn and grow and have accountability. And I have always, and I continue to say this, like, I've always appreciated people that DM me. I shared a tweet from a therapist that had been very racist and very demeaning towards women of color. And I didn't know that. And somebody shared with me, that particular information about that person and a few other things and resources. And I was like, oh, wow. And I, after digging in, unfollowed her. I think after a little while, I blocked this therapist because I was like, oh, man, this particular person that has a book out, and so I think I've always appreciated that. And I've said things on Twitter that I'm like, and that people have pushed back on. I'm like, oh, thank you. And so I think it's just a matter of who in our lives we know is wanting that accountability and wanting to grow. And I think hopefully we can have a culture that in this world where we do, realize that our language impacts people and impacts and can cause harm. Let's be open and have a willingness and a curiosity to learn. So,
yeah, I good. Think speaking
yeah,
of complex conversations, it's a great segue to talk about the event that's coming up where we're going to have some, wide ranging, nuanced and complicated conversations about a variety of topics.
Can I tell you something about the event?
Yeah.
I'm getting really excited. Tomorrow is February 1st, and I think that our episode will be out tomorrow. But I am, I get anxious because it's pulling together people. It's a lot of work. You know, there's some details to iron out. It's planning a pretty big event. And now we're getting close, and the pieces are all coming together, and registrations are starting to come in. I'm excited as fuck, man. Like, come on, are you excited?
I am really excited. It's wild that it's like come this fast, and we've been talking about it and we've been planning and to think about we're all going to be together and doing this thing in person and connecting hopefully with a lot of folks online as well it's really exciting. So the content warning event is happening, and I think we're pretty confident that if this thing is a success, in-person events and hosting events to be able to facilitate these kinds of conversations is a thing that you and I both want to continue doing. And I know it's especially a very big passion for you. And so, I'm beyond excited. I this will be the first time I've been in Portland during this time of the year to ever. So I get to experience the like a little bit colder, rainier Portland, because usually it's like June that I'm there.
Yeah, it'll be a good time. I know everybody wants to visit Portland in February. That's on everybody's bucket list.
I'm actually genuinely excited because I feel like I'm going to get a more authentic Portland experience than I ever have before. Because normally, I've been in like June or July, and I'm like, this isn't bad at all. It's blue skies and sunny. And they're like, yeah, this is the 4 weeks a year it's like that, okay? Thanks for coming and getting in the way while we're all trying to enjoy our 4 weeks of sunshine.
Yeah, no, exactly. We don't want people to find out about how great it is in the summer. But yeah, it will be good. I'm glad to have space for some conversations that I just haven't found necessarily in other spaces. And I'm not going to say our event will be perfect, you know, like, but I we're trying it because we want to open space for more inclusive conversations, for conversations that involve talking about polyamory, sex work, decolonization. And we do see some of those conversations in corners here and there, but we're just pulling them together for one event. And I really want to plug for our listeners the virtual option because it's only $35 and you get a recording too. So you don't have to be there live. If you're there live, we would love that because you can interact and you can ask questions and we'll have moderators that'll feed questions to our panelists. But if you can't come live, $35, man, I was actually, we were in a meeting about this and I was saying that my kids got invited to a Taylor Swift Eras dance party at the local community center and it was $40 a kid and all they're doing is putting on I don't know if I should say this on the air because I don't even know if what they're doing is legal, but all they're doing is putting on, I know, they're putting on the Eras movie and they're serving pizza and popcorn and we're paying $40 and I just think it's funny because you get $35 and you get all these like incredible people in one place having conversations about this topic that we're excited to facilitate. So
maybe that's what we should have done. Night one of Content Warning was put on the Eras Taylor Swift movie.
You know, it's not too late. We can secure a copy. Find out how the community center secured exclusive rights to have people pay.
Oh my God. The online version is going to be great, and I think that you said it and answered what we have had a lot of people ask is like if they, you know, it's President's Day weekend, people may have other stuff going on, or you know they're not able to sit and like tune in live for the whole event. It's you know a day and a half worth of content. You'll be able to you know watch that on demand content, whatever you can't catch live. But those who can tune in to any or all of it live, we are going to be very intentional about having a lot of interaction with the people who are attending online virtually. And not just, you know, interaction from one person, but hopefully multiple collaborators, multiple of us who are on different panels are also going to be engaging with the online audience, which I'm really excited about. And really kind of highlights something that is really, really important to you, really important to me as well, but you've been really waving the banner for accessibility, for these events, for community, for connection, and also just supporting the people who are a part of the collaborator team and the organizers who, you know, Janice is coming out from New York. We got people coming from various parts of the country, and you know, signing up and being there online helps, you know, support the event and support all the people that are collaborating because it's a big value of ours as well that, you know, it's not a huge amount, but we're able to, you know, do a little bit for those who are coming out, who are speaking and who are giving their time to make this event a really memorable and successful thing. So
yeah,
the online option is a great option. And if you can last minute fly to Portland, you can still get an in-person ticket. They're still available, and we would love to have you there.
And if you're in the area and you need a little bit of assistance, reach out. We've got a couple promo codes left. They're going fast.
I also want to like touch on one thing too that I feel is important because I've had different conversations with people who are like, well, I'm not sure. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not a particularly radical sexual person in terms of like, I'm a monogamous person or whatever. And like,
someone said to me or to somebody I know, I think I might be too sexually conservative for this event.
Yeah.
It's and kind I was of like what you're
what,
saying.
What is happening at this event that I'm unaware of that would stop you from being there? Anyway, but like, this isn't this is a place for like all different perspectives, embodiments on these topics. And we're not just talking about, it's not just sex ed. Obviously, we're going to have Erica Smith sex ed. We're going to have Dr. Tina, and we're going to be talking about sex and sexuality, but like in an intersectional context of like how that has been impacted by white supremacy and how that has been impacted by colonization, how it's been impacted by misogyny and patriarchy and by homophobic interpretations of scripture and, you know, homophobic institutions in, you know, there's all of these different elements. It's not just about like weak and bone now. So if that is kind of the brand that you're getting or the idea that you're getting, that's really not what this event is. It is really trying to bring together a lot of different context in these conversations. And to Megan's point, be open to all of the different intersecting perspectives and angles at looking at this, not from one particular lens, right?
Without prescription. And I think that's the key. It's like, we're not having you come. If you're somebody that wants to wait until you're married to have sex, go for it. Like, we are not telling you that you have to be sexually liberal in a specific way. But if what we do say is to not prescribe that ethic. That can be your own personal ethic. But we hope that you can learn from other perspectives and just gain insight to other diverse intersecting perspectives. Because that, I guess, I like to say the only thing I'm not prescriptive about is the only thing I want to be prescriptive about is not being prescriptive.
Yeah. Well, so, and I just think yeah. in a lot of these spaces, there tends to be like a desire for like a like maybe too much specificity in terms of like, I don't know if I could go. You think about these other events that are going on, like, am I religious enough to be at that event? Or am I think, you know, about, you know, queer QFC that just happened, the, you know, Queer Christian Fellowship, QCF, sorry, conference. And it's like, oh, well, like if I'm, you know, if I'm not queer, is that a space for me? Or, you know, sometimes people are like, okay, I don't know if this is, we even had people ask like, oh, I'm not a creator. I'm not a podcaster. Can I come to this event? I don't know who got the idea that you had needed to have like a podcast to come, but there was somebody who was like, oh yeah, I don't know. Can you just come if you're not, you know, an internet personality? And we were like, yeah, 1,000%. Like that's what this is for. We're wanting to have a really broad representation of people at these events. So like, I just think in the internet age, sometimes there's this like desire to like put especially events or, you know, even for us as a podcast, a lot of times we're like, people are like, are you a deconstruction podcast? And it's like, I don't know. We talked to, you know, are you just an ex-Christian podcast? And it's like, I don't think that we are just one anything. There's too many sides to this gem. You know, there's too many different angles to this thing. And personally, I get bored when things are just ex-Christian. Like, you know, I know that there's a big atheist conference that goes on that I've had friends go to that, again, no shade. I just like, I don't know if like, I like sometimes it's like, that's too limiting for me. And so I like that we're going to have queer people and straight people and cis people and trans people and religious people and atheist people and monogamous people and polyamorous people, all on our collaboration team, much less in attendance at this event. So I've been rambling, but that was an important thing for me to highlight too about the event and just kind of answer some of the feedback I've heard from other folks.
Well, yes, now that we've talked about that, let's jump in. We've got part two of Matt. We're excited to hear about that. And then also, we did have some listeners send in some audio clips. The hard part for us is that we got them from kind of a lot of different places, but it was so great. We listened to them and really love that you sent in your stories. We hope to highlight more folks and kind of figure out a better way to do listener clips in the future, because I'm not sure we might be able to include some on here. And if not, we're hoping to incorporate some of the stories into future episodes. But we heard from Jared. Thank you so much, who sent us in some stuff about his experience at Bethel, which I didn't go to Bethel, but was heavily impacted by Bethel through a church that was very connected to them.
Hey guys, this is Jared out of Kaiser, Oregon. What's going on? I use he, him pronouns, and I'm responding to your call for more information about those who kind of grew up in some of these service programs. And, you know, I hesitated at first because I didn't enroll in YWAM and I didn't attend IHOP in Kansas City. I actually did attend Bethel in Reading for a long time because we lived in Reading for a long time. And so that was, that will help explain a lot of the spiritual upbringing that I had. And so in middle school and high school, it involved a lot of, you know, kind of service type stuff. And we would kind of have challenges to witness to friends at school. And granted, it was a small town that I grew up in. And in high school, a couple of years, taking spring break trips to an orphanage that was probably an hour outside of Tijuana, not too far inside of Mexico. And this is kind of mixed because there were some really neat relationships that were built. And we would always have a few people with us that would build a decent building during the time that we were there. And so there was good being done. I get that. But the cost of taking a bunch of kids for a week down there, and of course, a lot of us were more interested in going to Magic Mountain at the end of the trip than anything else, you know. So again, it's mixed, but that was certainly one of the things. Later on in high school and eventually in college, that turned into a lot of, you know, street witnessing and things like that. And then I was involved a couple different summers with programs that were YWAM adjacent. And so a lot of what we're doing is skits with Carmen songs. And if you don't know Carmen, I admit I wanted to have a good description of him because I was thinking, how do you describe Carmen? And so the description I loved that I read is like operatic, story-driven music centered around spiritual battles. And they compared it to telling the stories of Frank Peretti via the song, the songmanship of Meatloaf. And so I thought, that's pretty close. I mean, I don't think he's as quality as Meatloaf, but at the same time, he had a good stage presence, Carmen did, and he was very entertaining. And so the sketch that I was involved in a lot was called The Champion, and it was this cosmic boxing match between Jesus and Satan. And I look at it now, and I have so many questions and so many issues with the way that story was told and what we're acting out. But I got to perform that that one on a couple different continents, and then a different similar one in South America. So three different continents I did things like this. And this was just summer, you know, summer trips and things like that. So certainly people who invested tuition and years of their lives in these programs. And I have close friends and even some distant relatives who have done that. And so I know the roots run deep, and it can be more difficult to kind of untangle some of that. But certainly some of those things are there. And hopefully this helps tell the story of your listeners.
Yeah, so Sierra, who's a friend, sent some clips. My good friend Jen from the UK, she was involved in a program that was kind of a part of the 24/7 prayer movement, which started over there. Sierra is very actively involved in the IHOP KC stuff that's currently really going on. There's a lot going on with ex attendees and staff of IHOP KC. And then I think Lindsay sent us a note about her experience
about
at YWAM. And so all of those were stories that we got. I listened to a lot of podcasts and I talked to Megan and I'm like, oh man, I would love to like be able to edit together things. But if I had to be the audio editor on our podcast, we would never put out an episode because it's not my skill set. So I apologize if we are not able to include those in this as I wanted to, but many of those stories are very similar to the things that Matt and we talked about on this first and second part of this interview, as well as hopefully stories that we can delve into in future interviews, having maybe some of those folks on the pod.
Yeah, but overall, I think that all of the stories put together along with Matt and the interview has given us a really interesting picture into what these environments are like and how toxic and they can be in those high control environments, how manipulative and abusive they can be. And I think about, like, it's so interesting to me too, and I'll say this and then we can get into it, but I think about programs that are like actual internships and trainings. Like, think about like AmeriCorps, right? Which is like, or Teach for America, where you can like, or the Peace Corps. But Teach for America, you can go and they have a need to put teachers into classrooms. You get paid. You have, you know, a degree that you can use afterward. Like and I'm not sure exactly how everything works. So I'm not a Teach for America person, you know, like, but like a promotional marketer. But there's skills that you can carry into then a future career. And then I think about the opposite where like they're paying to be there. And there's this mind fuck of like, and we addressed this on the part one, but like, you've paid money to be there. And so if you're questioning whether it's a good opportunity, it's like you got yourself into this situation. And I think that's the thing that's so hard to untangle when you're in it. And I am just really, I think it's taken a lot of courage and bravery for the folks that send in their stuff to speak out and talk about their experience. And then also say, you know, like talk about evolving out of that. And so thank you for sharing your stories and your pieces of you with us, because I know those are very personal. And we do hope to find a way to include some listener clips and have those audios on here. So let's get into it.
Yeah, let's jump into it. Our interview with part two of our interview with Matt the Snarky Giant.
All right, so we're back. Part two.
Yeah, part two. Right. Let's continue to hear about the kind of the classroom portion of what you're learning in this
yeah,
program.
So the classroom would be like, we had like that stuff about business. We had stuff about government where we were basically told Dominionist stuff about like the best way to do government is always to follow the biblical rules. So that was pushed very hard. We had to like do a thing where we presented a hypothetical constitution for a government based off of good biblical principles.
Oh, wow.
They were all basically the same. It was only like because we were taught like, no, like there are objectively in the Bible the rules for how to build a society. And it's very clear and very obvious. You can't argue about it. And yeah. It was so much so that like my mentor at one point talked about like, well, but all laws are legislating morality, right? If you say that murder is a crime, that's legislating morality. So obviously it's okay for us to say like abortion should never be allowed under any circumstances.
This is yeah. such and the...
The same. That it, is the same.
Well, and it reminds me... It reminds me, yeah. too, of how people are like, well, if you weren't following biblical values, quote unquote, if you love gay people, how are you not going to... murder people. Like it's like yeah. this piece where people think that like you need the Bible in order to know how to be a good human.
It's a bulletproof argument. Up. It's a bulletproof argument. I mean, if you love gay people, how are you not a serial killer?
It's absolutely something that's been in my DMs before. So no joke.
I'll touch on that narrative chain a little bit when we get to like the patriarchy and values around sexuality at this group. Mm. But to briefly touch on family and church, like it was just very conventional evangelical with like some additional spiciness thrown in about like, oh no, like we have to be like extra about everything because we're leaders and we're all like super Christians who have to like be even more intense about everything.
Above reproach, like, baby.
Yep. And just like lots of this, like, and obviously like church stuff was like basically that, like that pretend of like pretending to be pluralistic Christians who recognize that we can debate things, but at the end of the day, we're all good biblical Christians who, you know, we can, oh, what is it, the phrase, on essentials, unity, on non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, charity. But very obviously in these presentations on the Bible, they would have like some guest speakers in different parts of the year who were like maybe presenting something. But like the idea was like, oh, we could tell pretty quickly that, oh, everyone in this room actually does not believe that. No Christian in this movement believes those three things. It's, nope, I know everything that's correct. If you disagree with me about anything, you must be getting the Bible wrong. And, like, only one of us can be right.
Okay.
So,
that was
the theology.
I may be jumping us ahead, but that's fine. We can always, you know, kind of swing back. I want to talk a little bit about what the written and unwritten rules and kind of, like, understandings were about things like consumption, media consumption, what types of books, what type of music, what type of internet activity are you allowed to have, etc.
They were faux permissive in that, like, oh, like, they're not going to monitor, say, all of our media. But there was this edge of, like, but the best Christians are, of course, the people who only consume Christian media. So, like, if you're not listening to worship music or something that kind of sounds like worship music, why? Yeah. Why wouldn't you want to have something more edifying? For movies, though, specifically, we were not allowed to watch movies unless we did a 1-2 page report to our mentor in the program. And all of it was about, like, tying.
Face.
Oh, right. This is one of the things, like, oh, right, that's not normal. So that was a big thing. And in fact, you always had to tie your report back to some sort of biblical principle. It should be, like, you can't just watch Captain America, the Winter Soldier. You have to tie it to, like, stuff
make a
that
sermon
was going
about
on
it.
In Rev 5. Oh, that was my mentor, Joe. He would do that all the time. Any media, anything, he would try to spiritualize and be like, this is an example of this biblical principle.
I feel like they're delivering a fucked up version of leisure, right? Because it's like, leisure has to be work. If you want to run, not for pleasure. If you want to watch a movie, not for pleasure. Actually, pleasure doesn't exist. All of your leisure has to be spiritual.
Yeah. Everything has to be spiritual. When you're walking, we would go on like, we would go like camping or stuff. And like a lot of it would be like, oh, we're going on this hike. Look at this pretty vista. Now go do your quiet time while looking at God's beautiful creation and think about God and think about your life with God. And don't think about things besides Christianity and God and how you're needing to be less so that God is more, like, all that, like, so that was a lot of it. Was like, yeah, just this, like, oh, you want to consume media, okay, but like always have this inferiority complex if you're not like looking like these other people who are like, their idea of fun is listening to ambient worship music and like journaling and reading theology books. Like, that's, you're not as good as this person.
And that's why I say unwritten, because there is this unwritten. It's not like so many things there are for sure aspects of these organizations where there's like specific clear-cut rules. But 99% of the time there isn't. And it allows this plausible deniability that's like, well, anyone can leave anytime they want. Anyone can do anything that they want. No one's being forced to do anything here. Yep. You know,
it's just like, I'm sorry. It's just like Joshua Harris, right? Because it's like the whole, yeah, like, you should wait to kiss until you're married. There's so many pastors that would be like, we never taught that. Youth pastors that, like, we never told people that. But then there were teenagers that were like, but we read that book and decided that we would be more spiritual if we followed this guideline, yeah, that somebody invented.
And if you don't follow the guideline, when you struggle later, you are told, well, I mean, you guys didn't have sex until you were married, but, like, you guys were making out and you were, like, cuddling on the couch. Like, you were dancing. Like, it probably would have been wiser to have taken, like, if you break the rules that they want to enforce on you, later that will be held against you. Mm-hmm. If you struggle, it must have been because you weren't pure enough. You, mm-hmm, should have done more. And there's always more. You could have, oh, you didn't kiss, but you guys spent too much time alone together.
Yeah, so, and you prayed, like, together. Yeah,
there's a, uh-oh, new rule.
You had too, oh, good of a pray relationship. Together? Praying together was a we big were warned, no-no. Oh, yeah.
In Red that... 5, we were warned that, yep, the most dangerous time in your relationship with someone who you are, like, dating or getting married to, the most dangerous time was if you were praying together, because it was just going to be so intimate and spiritual,
so sexy,
that you would be so tempted to have sex. That was, like, so pressured. Like, we were told that narrative that, like, oh, guys, you have to be very careful here. This is basically the most dangerous thing you can do as an unmarried Christian, is pray with someone you are attracted to in private.
Like, okay, are we ready to get into the dating part? Because it feels, okay, like we're,
okay,
getting...
Okay, let's talk about it. On, great segue.
Since we were talking about the rules, I did want to touch on something, because this is a thing that I just forgot that is definitely going to be like, oh, this was a cult. So during the beginning, so that we would be more encouraged to, like, connect with each other, for the first 6 weeks, we were not supposed to call home unless it was on a weekend. So we weren't supposed to be in contact with our family, except in, like, very small chunks. For the first 6 weeks, it was supposed to be, we were just focused on this group. And it was presented like that. Like, it's just, look, you're going to spend, you have a limited amount of time at Rev 5. We want to make the most of it.
No.
And so we're just going to focus on our time together and learning about each other and telling each other our darkest secrets in this, like, retreat that we go to, where we all just dump our trauma out in each other. And there's no qualified therapist to, like, manage this. And we're all a bunch of, like, there were people like me who were, like, raised in evangelical homeschooling, who had a bunch of, like, I would say a lot of us had spiritual trauma, religion, you know, developmental trauma, stuff where it's like we were not raised safely. There were people who were missionary kids who had, like, a bunch of other things that they were dealing with.
You and, were,
like,
going dealing... through the trauma right then.
Like, yeah, that was... We were going through additional spiritual trauma as well. But, like, we're all, like, people who were just, we're very raw, and we were in the hands of people who meant well, probably, but had no training in therapy or handling trauma-informed stuff. So it was just like, they could pray for you.
This, I mean, I was
say
just,
some Bible verses.
I was just texting you about when I went to Salt Lake City, and there was all the folks that were waiting for people coming back on their missions, the Mormon, mm-hmm, the LDS missions. And I learned for the first time, and I don't know if this has changed, but I learned for the first time that they're not allowed to call home except for on Christmas, mm-hmm, or Mother's Day. And when I tweeted about it, people were like, yeah, when they come to our door, we actually ask them if they want to use the phone to call anybody. And I'm like, oh, this is like heart-wrenching that, like, they have to, like, that's the thing that you could get, the gift that you could give somebody is, like, you can make connection with your loved one. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. But again, here's the thing is, like, that is the appeal for these 17, 18, 19 year old, yeah, kids. The appeal, yeah, is this extreme. I remember, I think it's got to be Bill Hybels. Probably wasn't him that did it for the first time. Somebody used to tell this story about a military recruiter coming to a school, and there was, like, a Navy recruiter, and he was like, yeah, you can be in the Navy, and you can sail across, you know, all the oceans and see the world. And then the Army guy got up, and he was like, you know, here's all the skills you can do, you know, for signing up. If you sign up, you know, come see me afterwards. And the Marine got up, and he goes, nah, I see maybe one of you that could make it. I'll be over there, but I don't expect to talk to any of you. His line was, like, the longest, right? Because the idea is, if you make it seem, like, hard and impossible and, yeah, brutal, and then kids are going to go, like, wait, you can't tell me I can't do that. Like, they want to be. So leaders are kind of, like conditioned to challenge new entries to like make it hard to make it, because that's what is enticing about it, is like, oh, you're not gonna be able to call your mom, you're not gonna be able to, you know, this
or
is time part to
of
grow
it,
up.
I also think for young evangelicals, often, especially like if you were homeschooled, you have not had a chance to actually become your own person separate from your family.
Yeah.
So the idea of like, you won't be able to talk to your family for a while, it's like, do you promise? Like,
yeah, it's appealing.
But
then,
can I call them less?
It's an opportunity
you're
for
just
them
so
to shape you, not
stuck.
For you to shape yourself.
It's a chance, and it feels like you are choosing something for yourself and getting a chance to be the person you want to be. And then you realize later on, like, actually, they were trying to shape me into someone that they liked, and I was not myself then. But moving on to patriarchy, dating, all that fun stuff.
Let's talk about it.
Time.
Yeah, so Ref 5 was right in the middle of like the bit, one of the bigger booms of like the John Eldridge thing. Mm. So like it was very influenced by like Wild at Heart. What's the one?
Captivating.
Wild at Heart for Women.
Captivating.
Yes.
Which I believe, so we were divided into men's discipleship and women's discipleship Wednesday afternoons. So like guys would go, girls would go, and like separately do this stuff. And
somehow
I just don't
think that they were talking about like periods and erections and things like that.
Not a lot of like
actual
medically
education,
accurate, non-judgmental stuff. A lot of men's discipleship was very much around like, oh, we need to be like, it was that complementarianism, but very nicely presented, where it's just like, it's that John Eldridge, this is romantic and it's beautiful and poetic. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this harsh patriarchy stuff. It's just, you know, we just need to acknowledge, though, that men and women are different, and we have different roles that God has called us to. And as guys, we have to be the leaders. And actually, in hindsight, I was like, there was just so much stuff that I couldn't, like, process the amount of response. It felt too responsible for me. Like, I was just like, I can't handle the pressure of this when, like, they're telling me this is how your relationship with a, like, woman is going to have to look. You have to be this guy. And it's like, well, I'm never going to be that good, so I guess I'm single forever. But there was a lot of this, like, there was stuff where we would have to, like, talk about any of our sexual temptations, which I am going to be unpacking in EMDR therapy eventually, because that felt genuinely traumatic to have, like, literally no place you are permitted to hide. Like, you don't have to tell us, but if you're not telling us, you're not going to become a better Christian. You have to push yourself harder and like tell us everything, confess, because that's the only way for you to heal. And so
and
you have this pressure.
Not only that, but I'm imagining that a lot of the things that you were quote unquote confessing actually aren't bad things, right? Like, I saw this girl or I saw this guy and I, you know, like this or that. And it's like,
desire.
These are normal, healthy.
I had an erection.
Yes.
Yeah. Your goal was to not have any of that. Your goal was to, if you even thought of having a feeling of attraction, you could just shut it down like that. And they would like praise, like, here's a guy who went through the program and like, he takes cold showers every day. He like works out really hard. He does all these things. And does he struggle? No, because he's just that good.
He doesn't even like women
anymore.
He has
spiritual discipline, and he doesn't have to worry about struggling with these sorts of things anymore. And that was kind of like the idea, was like, yeah, you are either someone who knows what you need to do and does it to be a good Christian man, or you know what you need to do and you're not doing it, which means you just, like, you are the worst of the worst. You could be better, and you're choosing not to. How can you disappoint God like this?
And are people starting to pair off in this small group of
close-knit?
There was
dating?
Rules against, officially, you weren't supposed to date in Ref 5. That was a big no. Which, again, it's like, you're going to spend 9 months, and your group says you are not allowed to date within or without the group. No, we don't want you doing that. Again, not normal, I've realized in hindsight. And I've been in multiple groups which have told me to do that. Like,
side note about this, in the IHOP podcast that I just listened to, they said there was a rule about you couldn't start a relationship when you were like in your internship, but you could, like, if you had a pre-existing relationship, have it. So people would like take a 4 month break from interning to get into a relationship so they could go back into the internship as paired off.
I don't remember. I think there was some stuff where, like, some people were, like, having surreptitious relationships. I don't remember, partly because I was a 20-year-old being worked to the absolute limit of my emotional and physical capacity. So I feel like I'm like, yeah, I was not paying attention to that because I could barely function as a human during that time period. And I was not aware of that not being able to function. But I do think that there were, like, a couple people who, like, it turned out, like, oh, yeah, they were, like, dating on again, off again. They had, like, some conflict. But, like, the idea was you're supposed to not date right now. But they did give us, like, this, like, roadmap for, like, intentional dating, which was what they wanted us to do. And, in fact, at the end of that stuff, like, they gave us, like, resources that they wanted us to, like, they wanted us to make letters to our, like, future selves.
No.
Basically. For, and like, spouses. When we got into a relationship. Because, again, the idea was, all of you are good Christian leaders, which means all of you are going to get married and following this like intentional dating roadmap, because this is what good biblical leaders do. You need a spouse and you're not going to not get one.
Pause.
Because
I got to say something here, because I am married. I'm still married to the person I married in this group that I was in. But like I had a conversation. I remember talking to three other men that were in my church plant, right? Because my experience was a church plant, not a training program, which is kind of worse because it was like, this is for life. Like, you're never leaving. But I remember I was 18 years old when I got engaged, I think. Maybe 19, but I think I was maybe not quite 19 yet. And I remember, like, previous to going into this, I never wanted to get married. I didn't, like, think marriage was going to be for me. I was, like, not that interested in even having a relationship with one person.
I have a question. Did you have, like, balloons that spelled 18 when you turned 18 and got engaged? Or was there, like, the countdown
finally until Portland's 18
of age?
We should have. I'm going to Photoshop that. If you don't get that reference, there's a great thing that you can Google later about youth pastors and kids turning 18. Here, I remember saying out loud, I don't want to get married. And my spouse knows this. And the three other men in this room, this like pastor's office, were like, none of us wanted to get married. literally 3 minutes, they're like, but you have to. Like, this is like, how would you lead the church if you can't lead your family? You have to have a spouse to lead, or no one will follow you. So it's just a requirement. You just have to do it.
There was also in Rev 5 this, like, even though they were pushing that, like, austerity of, like, oh, like, nothing should be more important to you than your relationship with God, but also your relationship with a romantic partner is going to be, like, the second most important relationship, because this is where you learn about how God feels about you, and, like, you love your spouse, and that shows them the love of God, and, like, it was very, like, and the roadmap for intentional dating was, like, this very, like, you have to make, especially if you're the guy leading the relationship because, you know, patriarchy, you have to make it super special. You're the one. You are basically a proxy of God to your spouse in, like, showing them, showering them with excessive attention and grandiose romantic gestures. So it was, like, yeah, like, the engagement idea of, like, proposing was supposed to be, like, some ridiculous, like, the kind of, like, ridiculous things that people go to, because you need to show this person how much God loves them by showering them with attention and affection and love. And, like, and also, like, they also did not have a healthy concept of consent. And I know this because the guy who was, like, leading the program and was my mentor loved to tell us about how he courted his wife, which was that he met her at church. She didn't particularly, like, take a liking to him. Like, she wasn't
I've heard this story so many times with so many men.
Oh, my God.
So he befriended all of her siblings and, like, wormed his way into her life and was just, like, a fixture, and all of her siblings loved him. And eventually, like, he wore her down and they got married. And that was, like, the picture we were taught. And I remember, even during Rev 5.
A werewolf that imprinted on her? Because this sounds very Twilight-y. I'm sorry. But
during Rev 5, I remember thinking to myself, okay, but, like, surely at some point you don't keep pursuing some... Like, there's...
Yeah.
You have to take a no at some point, right? Like, obviously, there's a limit here, right? And I just, like, in hindsight, I'm like, nope, they did not accept that. Like,
does God not continue
to... a guy felt led by God to pursue.
Yeah, does God not continue to chase his bride? Will God not go to the ends of the earth?
God doesn't respect consent, and neither do we. Like, that was essentially the narrative.
Yeah, to get you back.
You don't get to opt out when God makes a decision. And that was the culture, and they were also just very... It was very patriarchal, and it was very, you know... It was very... weirdly obsessed with sexual pleasure, though, in that, like, the idea of, like, once you get married, you know, it's gonna be, oh, guys, it's gonna be so good. It's gonna be so wild. You have no idea. And, like, I remember also trying my best to be, like, this, like, okay, we need to be pure. We don't even need to think about these things, right? So I'm gonna do that. And I remember at a table, like, we were making casual conversation about, like, you know, like, what would you do when you're on your honeymoon? And, like, I remember, like, suggesting, like, oh, you know, like, we would want to go to, like, a city or something. Because, like, you could, like, go around and, like, go to museums or stuff like that. Like, have some fun time with your partner after getting married, you know, to after the stress of the wedding. And, like, a couple people kind of, like, almost looked at me with, like, this sort of, like, mocking pity of, like, oh, Matt. That's not what you do during the honeymoon.
You
want to
hang out with the person instead of just have wild sex with an object?
Yeah, and like specifically one person, and I cannot for the life of me remember who, but somebody did just incredulously go, Matt, how are you ever going to get married?
Oh my God.
Because like you're not thinking about your honeymoon being a wild sex extravaganza. Ugh, like you're hopeless. Like no one's going to want you. Like, there's this weird, like, or you're like, you're just like this hopeless child of like, I don't think Matt's like into this. He's never going to get married.
Wow.
And just like, and then and part of me was just like, but I'm trying to follow the rules that you guys want for me.
Yeah.
What? And like, yes, this is weird. Don't ever think about sex, but also only ever think about sex with your godly spouse. Try to square that circle. Like,
well, the things you should be confessing at your forced accountability is how much you're struggling with how much you fantasize about your future wife, I guess. Is that the
it's just,
goal
yeah,
there?
It's a weird thing. And they also just had this like this idea that like if you were not like absolutely perfect in every aspect of your like romantic relationships or sexuality in general, like that was just the start of a slow decline that would result in you becoming a horrible person. Like my mentor had this whole routine. He had a flair for the dramatic, so he loved doing these like sermons kind of things where he would have like a illustration. So for this one, he would always have someone holding like some rope and they would like wind it around him as he talked. He'd be like, all right, so you start off and you start having sex with your girlfriend and you're watching porn or something. And like, and he would like get increasingly like tied up as he like describes, like, so you get your partner gets an abortion because like you don't want to deal with the consequences of your choice and you get a little bit more wrapped up. And then like you start watching porn.
You slowly
and you start
take your pants off.
To men.
Then you have underwear
on. And then soon
the
porn isn't enough, so you're watching more intense stuff.
You
and
take
then
that
you're going
underwear
to sex
off.
Workers.
And
then it, and he would like tie himself, and basically his path was, it would end with you, in his mind, he believed that like, if you didn't have like perfect spiritual control over your sexuality, you would end up seeking child sex trafficking victims.
Yeah. And that man is into...
And that's what we were told.
That man is into rope play now. I just want to say that's his kink, I'm sure.
I mean, I it was funny in hindsight. I'm like, he talked about spiritual bondage, and I'm like, oh, Joe, like, you need to, like, change this presentation up because you're just creating a new kind of kink. But it was... That was the, like, standard, which is this, like, you are, like, if you aren't perfect, you are going to destroy everything in your life. And that was just... Every aspect of this was just this heavy-handed, like, you have to just try so hard, and if you make any mistakes, you're doomed. Because, like, you just have to confess those immediately, or you're going to start turning into the worst person possible.
I'm just going to 15 seconds, 10-second rant, because here's the thing. They make it sound like you're going to get married and have this, like, spiritual orgasmic moment every single day of your marriage. Like, you're going to connect in this physical, spiritual, sexual, all of these things way. And then, like, they get mad at us because they say we're deconstructing for the sex. And it's so funny because the sex is so much better when God's not in the bedroom with you. I just need to say that. I'm sorry. I just, whether you're alone, whether you're with a partner, the sex is so much better. And we're not deconstructing for that, but it's just something that you discover when you start deconstructing. Okay, rant over, continue.
Well, but that was, so that actually was a thing that they had. We had like a Valentine's Day retreat where we would talk about relationships and stuff. And that was specifically one of the leaders did basically say, like, when you've done everything right, you go to have sex with your partner for the first time and God's going to be there and it's going to be fine. And you're not going to feel any shame or guilt. And it was like, yeah, literally, we were told God is going to be a voyeur to your first time sexual
experience. I've heard this, like, God's a cuck, like thing before.
Look, I am not an exhibitionist, I've realized.
God
I think.
Is actually and the so, elf on the shelf in your bedroom. Letting you know if you're naughty or nice.
But, yeah, it's just, it's, there's just, that was, like, so much of the dynamic was like, yeah, like, weirdly obsessed with how our future relationship would go. We should be like, everyone's expected to get married. There's like this huge pressure almost to like get married very young. Lots of people are getting married in their like early 20s who had gone through this group. And it was just so heteronormative, patriarchal, just no space for queerness. And I remember like, even in like the men's group, in hindsight, I'm like, again, sign that I kind of didn't fit in. I didn't really get a lot, like, I tried my best to do, like, okay, I'll do the Wild at Heart thing, I can be a, like, adventurer, kind of, and just never feeling like I clicked with the rest of the men in the group in that way, and feeling like my relationships with some of the women students were stronger, and realizing in hindsight, yeah, that was probably because I was bi and did not fit their standards of what a man is like.
There's a wild cause and effect assumption that happens about sexual things in these spaces too, where like, and I see this, like, I'll get these, like, I follow this Instagram account, this like Best Christian Memes account, because I think the memes are interesting sometimes, but it's like very Christian, but they do these like paid advertisements sometimes for this like anti-porn, like porn. Ooh. And like the
is it like, Covenant Eyes, Triple X Church?
It's something like that. It's not those, but it's like Freedom from Porn. And they use these slides that's like talking about like, I don't know, Dahmer, or talking about like some like serial killer, and like, oh yeah, it started.
It was James Dobson interviewed Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah, it all started with porn.
All of his murder and violence on porn, wow. Which was a lie. Dahmer, you know, was basically, Dahmer got, like, we realized he had an opportunity to blame anyone but himself for some of the worst crimes a human has committed, and Dobson let him do it because Dobson wanted to abuse young evangelicals and make them afraid of themselves.
But I remember, so here's the thing is, like, so there's this idea, this false correlation that, like, oh, you watch porn, you're going to become a serial killer, which is just a wild jump in logic.
Yeah.
But, I remember when I was a teenager, I started smoking cigarettes, and my mom took me to, like, our family doctor practitioner, and I remember she expected him to be, like, you know, scare me straight, and, like, you know, and he basically was like, hey, this is not good for you. He's like, but like what my mom, the narrative my mom had said is like, oh, it starts with cigarettes and then it's weed and then it's cocaine and then it's, you know, crack and then you're, you know, whatever. Then you're going to like ruin your life and be on meth. And my doctor was like, that's just not true. He was like, the reality is like, sure. Like
these are different substances that have different effects.
Yeah. Do people who become addicts maybe oftentimes also smoke cigarettes or smoke cigarettes first? Sure. He's like, are there tons of people who smoke cigarettes and never do meth? 1,000%. He was like, let's not like just assume that because you do this one thing. And I stuck with me that like this idea that like this false equivalency is like, well, you let this little thing in. It again is like this excuse to control every little piece of, you know, oh, well, you know, you ate a dessert when, you know, you didn't need to, you're probably going to be an alcoholic because you can't control yourself, right? Like there's like this correlation between like, if you can't fast, you know, for days at a time, you're not going to have the spiritual power to be able to resist temptation.
Yeah.
And that was just a lot of that culture, just this intensity constantly, just trying to be at 100%.
Megan, what were you going to say?
I have a question, but it's going to jump. And so I have a question about like how this whole year wrapped up and when you had your Michael W. Smith friends or friends forever moment. But before we get to that, I want to know, like, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you're like, oh, I also have this that I need to get out there if I'm going to unpack this toxic year of my life?
I mean, there was just a lot of it was just this like, so we would go on like trips, but we weren't allowed to know in advance what we were doing.
Like what kind of trips? Thing.
Like we would go camping a lot. It's like we would like go hike into some location, set up tents, and then like go explore stuff like that. We went to Utah, and that was like a big trip because they have like it's every year. Former students are invited to like go back, and it's like a retreat almost. And like I went back a couple of times.
I was going to ask you. You went back to see the current class. Yeah. Oh, and wow.
And so it was like this very just like a lot of it is just these very intense like, oh, you're on like a road trip and you're camping and you're in Utah and it's like beautiful terrain and, you know, you're with
it's just wild Mormons feel, just
like,
everywhere.
It feels like very intense relationships. And I was actually thinking recently, because this is actually 10 years since I did this program. So wow. This 10 years ago, I would have been in the middle of it. I do sometimes miss it a little bit because there is like something about like, you know, just you didn't have like outside of the program, you didn't have other responsibilities. So there were times where it was just like you have like some friends and you're in a van and you're in Utah camping and it's late at night and there's a fire and you're talking late. And like there is something that I feel like I miss. And I feel like that's something that maybe people get in college if they have like a very tight group of friends mm-hmm. going into it. The entire span of their college time, like they go on trips together, they kind of keep in touch. And like, I didn't get that being a homeschooled kid. And so this was my version of it. And I do kind of like, there is like part of me that wishes it wouldn't have been in this very unhealthy relationship or structure because, you know, there is something like kind of beautiful about like some people getting together and having this time to be really close. And sometimes I feel like I can't get that again.
It reminds me of like when a relationship ends, right? And you're reflecting on like this, okay, this relationship had to end because of this, this, and that. But like, that doesn't mean that it was everything about that relationship was horrible, but there might be some memories that you look back mm-hmm. on. You're like, oh, I'm kind of nostalgic there.
Yeah. Yeah. So and the even, end even of if it's, five,
even if it's toxic or abusive, right? Even an abusive yeah. relationship, yeah. you look back on and you're like, oh, there was aspects of that, that like, I can't just shut out that shaped me and were a part of me becoming who I am.
Yeah. So, all right, yeah, so let's go to the end.
The end of Rev 5, which my... So they have, like, a graduation event, and they, like, invite people. And mine was at, actually, I believe, the World Prayer Center at New Life Church.
Been yeah, there.
Which was, like, one of the leaders for... the group had like worked in New Life's version of like a leadership school before starting like a separate independent group. So again, another backtrack. So a big part of Rev 5 was this thing that they called your creed. And your creed was like this sort of, it was at the time, it was a very big thing in evangelical spaces that were trying to be trendier, was to get really into spoken word. Because spoken word is something that can sort of sound good even if you're terrible at it and put no focus in. But if you get like a very overproduced video of a guy in a V-neck t-shirt saying words and the camera moves in and he talks like this.
And you put a little cigarose or explosions in the sky behind him.
You put some like text on the screen and maybe have it mimic the flow of the words that he's saying. And he's saying something very judgmental about how you're spending your life wasted. But he says it in a way that almost sounds inspirational.
And wear sunscreen.
There's a call. And it's just like, I hate that genre now because I'm just like, it was garbage. But it was a very big thing in the like mid-10s to be super into spoken word.
Dude, there is a video, I just have to say, Stephanie Drury, who is Stuff Christian Cultures Likes on Twitter and whatever,
yeah.
who's the guy from the church in South Carolina? Furtick? Stephen Furtick made one of those like Stephen spoken Furtick. Word videos specifically responding to her, where he doesn't say her name, but it was like just in response to something that she had posted, and is like, hey, haters, you're out here trying to stop the Lord. But it's like that exact spoken word thing that like it's glorious.
It approximates profoundness.
Yes, exactly.
It sounds kind of like it should be profound. And so if you're not appreciating it as profound, you feel like you must not be getting how good it is, because like clearly a lot of work has been done with this. I'm sure the message is good. But so Rev 5, we would make our creeds, and this is like this long thing, and this is something I can't find anymore, because one of the parts of my early deconstruction was I remember throwing away my creed. Mm. And that was like a big thing for me. It was like, I'm getting rid of this. I'm not keeping a copy of it. This is gone from my memory. But like my creed that I worked on throughout the year was like this thing of like me talking about like I owed God an infinite debt I could never hope to repay, but fortunately God forgave me, and now I just want to give everything for God, and like just this very self-deprecating and just insisting that like what I needed to do with my life was to give it to God so I could save the world, basically. And we would read our creeds at this graduation event where like family had been invited. It was like a fancy dinner. Students from previous years would like agree, just come to help out, like serving food and stuff. Again, like there was a lot of this, like people from previous years stuck around and kind of got enmeshed with the community still. And so I read my creed, and like at this time it just felt very much like, oh wow, this is like really powerful and I'm like gonna change the world. But also like there were moments even in the graduation where it was like very clear that like I was only fitting in. Like as we went across the stage to like accept our little graduation certificates, we were hugged by the staff, and my mentor Joe made a big deal about making a joke about how when he hugged me, he mentioned like, oh, by the way, Matt's not really a hugger, but we're working on it.
Okay.
Because throughout the year, I had kind of been this much more like reticent person, not willing to like, not as engaged in physical touch, because like that wasn't my love language, right?
Yeah.
Because we had like talked about like, what's your love language?
All the noises Megan is making is my favorite.
I'm sorry. Oh,
by the way, if you want to talk if anybody listening wants to hear a beautifully brutal takedown of the five love
languages. I was just
going to
say this. If books
go
could
listen
kill.
To the podcast, If Books Could Kill, their episode on it shows how utterly stupid that entire book is. It's just nonsense that Gary Chapman made up.
I had a rage run fraud. Listening to that podcast episode. Yes, I totally recommend
it. But anyway. So even though my love language wasn't physical touch, that wasn't what, like, I was like, I think I'm like a words of affirmation and quality time person. Nope, not acceptable. My mentor and other people around me did try to just straight up be like, nope, we decide that you should like physical touch more, and we're going to push you in that. And so, like, the entire year, I just didn't get a chance to, like, choose whether or not I accepted physical touch. I just had it pushed on me by my mentor. And, yeah, so, like, there were these moments where it's just like, yeah, even if you're part of this group, you are different, and you just have to, like, just accept the hug from your mentor and hug him back. Because you just need to fit in.
Yeah. And this is where I kind of want to bring up that there is this, as you're talking about this thing that's happening in graduation and the mentor and the people involved, there is this simultaneously self-deprecating and self-aggrandizing thing that's happening with everyone in these organizations. And there is not this like clear abuser, leader, manipulator person, and abused, manipulated person. It's like very like circular, and like everybody and in it is experiencing trauma and participating collectively in shared trauma at the same time. So there's no one to even really point a finger to. And we've talked about this before with like Hillsong culture and like, you know, the dude in New York or whatever, like, oh yeah, he caused all these issues. But also like he was a part of this bigger Hillsong system that he was a victim of in some sense. So like, I don't know. There's just this like, it's churning out people to like buy into his idea.
I think the complexity there is also, it's just like, these are groups that don't form with the intent of like, all right, so we're going to take a bunch of 20-somethings and we're just going to psychologically break them down. We don't care about their well-being. We're going to rip them apart and make them compliant weapons for us. They're doing what they think is right because it's like they were raised in a similar culture.
Exactly.
But this is something that the and this is something where it's like a lot of churches will like, or pastors or theologians will complain about groups like YWAM or IHOP or different groups like this. But they usually get mad about it having quote unquote bad theology. And so that's usually where the harms are chalked up to, is these people aren't properly biblical. So these groups, though, the primary harm is, like, the way they're structured. But the problem is the way they're structured is something that is, like, mimicking American Christianity in general. And also, these groups are indispensable. You can't have American Christianity continue. American conservative, evangelically Christianity needs these kinds of groups because... how else, like, what are they going to do with a bunch of disillusioned young people who've grown up not having, like, church be a thing that they were relieved to go to because finally they had something to, like, rely on from their life? Because, like, that's adult converts go in and it's like, this is different. This feels like something that's helping me. When you're raised in the church, all you ever know of it is this, like, burden that also is not rewarding you.
It's unescapable.
Because you're just pushed and pushed and pushed. And you're not enough. You're constantly being told you're not enough. You were told you were not enough from when you were born. So it sucks. So you get to like 18, 19, and you're like, I don't know what I want to do with my life. And they can use these groups to be like, see, what you need to do is get more into Christianity.
Double down.
That will solve your problems.
Double down.
And without that, what are they going to do? They're just going to have more people leave.
Yeah.
So they need these. They need crew. They need...
yeah.
They need IHOP, they need 24/7, they need all these hyper-intense, borderline abusive, even if accidentally, groups, because otherwise, no one would stay. Because, like, what the hell are you staying for? There is nothing here. All you've done is go to church for 18 years and watched as nothing changed in your life.
Well, and then you get out of those.
Not healthy.
And you, what happens, right? You go into the real world and nothing mimics that, and then you... you have the shame of not being able to, like, live the way that you were told that you had to live because you're living, you're working a regular job, you're, yeah. Like, I don't know how many years I was a bilingual elementary teacher and felt so much shame for having taken the, what, low road of becoming a teacher in
Spanish.
Instead
of a missionary.
Instead of a missionary? Like, how fucked up is that
and
I thought
that
best, I couldn't do
at
that?
At best, you could just kind of be like, but I'm getting money so I can give it to a missionary or a church plant or... but, like, so the thing I've also noticed is, like, so there's also this pressure, like, once you get out of these programs, like, your life tends to fall apart, kind of. Like, when you're in the program, you feel really engaged, and then you leave... and it goes away because it was only this high intensity, almost emotional high of being pushed well beyond your limits. That was what you were feeling. You weren't feeling the Holy Spirit or whatever. So you get kind of in this in your head, there is like this either like when you're getting close to leaving or after you've left, there's this idea that like if you just go back, that'll fix it. Like, so that's why like benchmarks exist. That's why like YWAMs, DTS, and other programs, they rely on people staying in the program or coming back to it to lead. That's why, like, all these groups are very much like, once you get in the sphere, you feel like you need to stay in the sphere. You don't, weirdly, this group that's all about how we're equipping you to go into the world to help people wind up never doing that. You stay in the group. Mm-hmm. You only ever do things with members of the group. Because when you step out of that sphere, it's just you don't feel anything. And you need to be in there because that's the only place you're feeling this hyper-spiritual standard that you were expected to meet. And otherwise, or you get into like the evangelical shadow economy where like you work for evangelical church plants and parachurches and whatever, like for paltry sums of money. And that's what you do after this. Like, you don't go into the normal world anymore. Or if you do, you suddenly just feel incredibly weird about everything because you can't seem to implement the magical system that they told you you should be able to do on your own. Like, I can't feel like a leader now. Like, why isn't this working anymore? I can't keep up with my quiet times. I feel like I've lost everything.
Help us land, here's, Megan.
Here's my question, because I can't leave on this note, because we've like unpacked all this toxicity and all of this trauma, right? And I want to leave with a nugget of like things that you've done to heal from this, because you mentioned EMDR therapy. You mentioned even like almost a ceremonial, like I'm going to get rid of this creed. Like what else have you done just for our listeners that have kind of come out of maybe not the high control system, but like knowing just even evangelicalism or whatever people are coming out of, because so many of our listeners are there. What are some things that you've done to kind of heal and I guess deconstruct this whole experience?
Yeah, so like some of the things I've done, so just learning about myself, learning to accept, you know, I don't have to be perfect anymore. I think one of the things that actually, so workouts in Rev 5 were just so brutal that I think it genuinely has like made it hard for me to feel okay keeping up with any sort of physical routine. Yeah. Because like there was just this shame of like, no, you have to push yourself beyond what you're capable of. And kind of break yourself. It's like that kind of hurt a lot of my ability to engage. And so like recently I've been getting really back into yoga, and there's a very like embodied practice in yoga where it's all about like doing what you're capable of in the moment. And like if you're doing a yoga video or in a classroom, instructors will often be like, you know, if you need to adapt this to what your body is currently capable of, that's okay. And like I've even done things where like I'm in the yoga video watching and it's like, here's the thing that the instructor's doing. This is too much for me. I'm just going to go do child's pose and just rest for a minute. And that is okay, because I'm allowed to set boundaries on my physical body. And that sort of thing, I think, has been helpful. Moving was a big part, just being away from the space where I was in this group, because there's just, I don't know, there's something that like does sit in the back of your head when you're in these environments that are similar to where you were when you were involved in a high demand group.
I can't imagine. Colorado Springs is triggering enough.
Oh yeah,
just it's for anybody.
Yep. another thing was just like understanding my own experience as a queer person. Like I'm bi. How does that like affect my masculinity and what I understand being a man to be has been very helpful in like deconstructing this like heteropatriarchal standard of like you have to be like the perfect wild at heart man or you're not worth anything. And like, hey, I actually like being a man. Like, that's actually been a thing of, like, untangling my bisexuality has actually made me feel happier in my gender. Like, because it feels like it's connected and it makes me go, oh, this is masculinity for me. And it fits now. It's not me trying to fake being this super ultra-Christian, profound spiritual leader, adventurer, cowboy that, like, no one can meet the standard.
I love it.
It's just, also just... Yeah, just being accepting, like, yeah, I don't have to, like, make everything important. Things could just be. You can have friendships. They don't have to be a mentor-mentee, super intentional relationship where you are either teaching someone how they should live or being taught how you should live. I don't have to have every trip be a spiritual journey. I don't have to have my job be changing the world. Like, I have permission to just exist. And that is, like, I think another big thing that I've worked on over the years, and I'm still working on, because like these kinds of groups, I feel like the thing I remember years ago thinking was this group kind of broke my off switch. Like this group put me on maximum output and then just broke the off switch, and like, no, you should always just be doing, or if you're not doing, you're resting spiritually intentionally and doing something, right? There, so having space to be like, no, I don't have to be productive. I don't have to be perfect.
You might
have
even
to be...
say you would be living a purpose-driven life.
Yeah. I'm like, it's okay to be purposeless at times.
Oh, you just and reminded weirdly, me that I lost a bet and I'm supposed to be reading that book right now. Well, Matt, we really appreciate it. I know it's not easy to dive into all of this stuff, but I do want to give
about
you
a lot.
You had, I know you're not on the Twitters as much these days. Where can people find you to?
Yeah, I'm very active on Blue Sky, which I think will eventually be dropping the invite code requirement so people can freely join. But there's plenty of codes available if you know where to look. So
DM me.
If you
want to
join
like
me on Blue Sky, it's got that like peak I don't know, 2010s Tumblr chaos energy, so it's great. Lots of queer people there. I'm also probably going to be doing some more writing. I really want to unpack some purity culture stuff that I read a few years ago that has still made me angry. So I have, I may be opening up some sort of blog or newsletter to
Substack.
Like, do some decoding.
I would love to subscribe to your Substack.
I'll see what I look at for that. But like looking at unpacking some of this stuff, I'm going to be at the Content Warning event.
Woohoo!
So that'll be fun. If you want to see me in person or watch live stream, I will be there. So,
yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. As a third time, we'll get that jacket ready for your five timer whenever you.
Well, and this was a two-parter, so now it's four.
Technically, yeah, you're only one away.
Yeah. I love defining those standards down to like, it's like writing a to-do list and intentionally including some things you already did so you can hit that dopamine. Made it.
Thank you for being here. It means a lot to us, and I think a lot of people are going to be able to relate to the stuff we talked about today. So thanks a ton.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Alrighty.
All right.
We did a lot of intro on this episode, so we'll keep the outro short. Anything specific that you want to touch on before we do kind of the close out and where to find us?
We talked about our event, so contentwarningevent.com. If you're looking at that, you can find the podcast at Thereafter Podcast on Instagram, Thereafter Pod on Twitter. I can't stop going on Twitter, so find me at The Pursuing Life and on all the places. I go into Threads a little bit. And then Cortland, I'm just going to go for you because I'm not sure about your connectivity right now. You can find Cortland at Cortland Coffee. Check him out on MySpace. MySpace is this hot new place where the kids are hanging out these days. Just kidding. He is on MySpace, but he can't get in to take his account off. And then check out our Patreon. If you like hearing what we do, it helps support our editor, Cody. Thank you. Who edits our episodes and helps give us a little bit more bandwidth for our subscriptions and things like that. So I think we're just under breaking even now, so that's good.
Yeah.
Thanks everyone, and I guess until next time.
Until next time.